Worldwide, cardiovascular disease affects the lives of hundreds of millions. Dedicated cardio nerds everywhere are working hard to fight this global epidemic. These are their stories.
Welcome back, cardio nerds. This is going to be an amazing episode as part of our CNCR series. We are in Baltimore, my hometown, and back in my alma mater, University of Maryland, with some amazing cardiologists. We are here today with Dr. Andrew Lutz, Dr. Colin Suarez, and Dr. Angie Molina. And we are so pumped to be talking about a very important case in cardiology.
Hey, everybody. Really excited to be here. I'm Andrew Lutz. I am a PGY5 second year cardiology fellow, Maryland. Went to med school in Maryland and did residency at UPMC. Was happy to come back to Baltimore, be home with my Ravens. I am a huge, huge, huge Ravens fan. A little disappointed about the season this year, but oh well. We'll get over it. Outside of medicine, I'm actually a big racket sports enthusiast. I play tennis. I play paddle tennis. And I am interested in going into general cardiology with a little flavor of medical education. So yeah, happy to be here.
All right. My name is Colin Suarez, and I'm originally from New York. I did my undergrad med school in Texas, went to med school at Texas A&M University, go Aggies. Came up to Rhode Island, went to Brown for my internal medicine residency, and now I've come down here to University of Maryland for a cardiology fellowship. I'm now PGY5. I'm interested in going into advanced heart failure transplant cardiology after general fellowship. In my spare time, I enjoy fishing, one of my hobbies that I've had since childhood and gotten better at it during med school.
Hey, I'm Angie. I'm originally from Miami, Florida. I went to undergrad at University of Florida, so go Gators. I then went further north to Richmond, Virginia at VCU School of Medicine for my medical school training. And then I came to Baltimore, Maryland for University of Maryland MedPeds program for 4 years. I'm currently a first year adult cardiology fellow, so PGY5, and I loved it so much that I stayed. I absolutely love Baltimore. There's so much to do here. I particularly enjoy hiking and kind of doing day trips to West Virginia or Pennsylvania or deep into Maryland to get some good hikes out there, or even just going to the beach out east. So many things to do. Also, indoor gardening has been a slow passion, developing passion of mine. It's been fun. It's been fun to be here. Very excited to be with you both.
Well, that's awesome. Andrew, Colin, and Angie, what an honor to be with you guys and hang out. So, Angie, you talked about some of the outdoor types of things, you know, and probably, I guess, we'll venture out of Pickle's pub to have a great case. But where would you guys like to set the scene so we could talk about some serious cardiology?
Yeah, so there are a lot of great places in Baltimore to hang out, but one of our favorites is actually a little off the beaten path downtown with a little bit of history. So in any time of year, you can get down to Fort McHenry, escape the crowds, just take a walk around the pier down by Locust Point and just watch the waves, watch the boats go by, take in a little history about the War of 1812. So we're going to sit down there, pretend it's spring, and while watching the cherry blossoms, and maybe kick it for a drink and enjoy some cardiology.
That sounds fantastic. All right, drinks are in hand. I've got my brewski here, although right now I'm in a keto phase, so it's really my vodka seltzer. But yes, start us off.
All right. So the case, we have a young female in her early 20s without any known past medical history. She presented to the emergency department with a chief complaint of throat pain and shortness of breath after she had snorted illicit street drugs. In the emergency department, she subsequently was then seen tripoding, having acute respiratory distress, and she developed PEA arrest. CPR was performed and ROSC was achieved after about 4 minutes with one round of epinephrine. She was intubated with some difficulty, and she was noted to have epiglottic edema in her airway, subsequently having another PEA arrest, and ROSC was obtained about 3 minutes later. Subsequently, she developed severe shock after intubation, requiring norepinephrine, epinephrine, and vasopressin infusions. Her past medical history was not known initially, but subsequently was found that she had a history of bipolar disorder and preterm pregnancy. No prior surgical history. She was not taking any medications, and she did not have any allergies. Family history was not initially known, but subsequently found that her father had heart disease and seizures, Social history was remarkable for homelessness and housing insecurity, as well as illicit drug use. Okay, Andrew and Angie, clearly this patient is very sick. This young female in her early 20s, who all of a sudden comes to the ER after snorting illicit street drugs, completely decompensates with respiratory distress and is now in decompensating shock, requiring 3 pressors. What are some of the initial thoughts that come to your mind as to what could be going on with this patient?
Yeah, Cullen, that's a great summary. And certainly we're all very concerned about this patient. You know, I'm thinking about cardiac arrest and then severe shock afterwards. You know, I think they're usually going to be tied together. And that always comes back to the H's and the T's, right? Especially of cardiac arrest. When you think of toxins, you think of cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, coronary pulmonary thrombosis, trauma, and then of course all your H's, you know, hypoxia, hypovolemia, acidosis, hypokalemia, etc. But in the context of this patient, in the context of drug use and a sore throat and epiglottic edema, I think we're focused on a few things. Certainly anaphylaxis to either an ingredient in one of the drugs was certainly high on the differential. And then other common things being common, septic shock, right? Other kinds of shock, other kinds of distributive shock, you know, spinal shock would be quite rare, hypovolemic shock for whatever reason. And then of course, cardiogenic shock, just to round things out, especially in someone who had a cardiac arrest, you always have to think about. It wasn't really clear at the time of her presentation what was causing the sore throat and epiglottic edema. Certainly anaphylaxis would be one of the more common causes, but always have to worry about other infections that are usually rare, viral, even certain bacterial infections that could cause this and sometimes lead to a septic shock type picture. So that's essentially where we were, at least just initially triaging her.
Thank you, Andrew. That was really thorough differential. One other thing I wanted to add, and it's kind of rare regarding the throat, is Lemierre's disease. I don't know if you've heard of that. You can have it, especially in young individuals, infection of the throat that can cause even a septic thrombus in the internal jugular vein. That could be cause for a shortness of breath, sore throat. And that septic thrombus could even lead to a PE, which causes arrest. So that's another rare thing to maybe consider in a young patient like this. All right. So this critically ill patient, we have a broad differential diagnosis. We really need to have a physical exam to help guide what is going on here. So Angie, can you please take us to the bedside and tell us what we're seeing?
Thanks, Andrew and Cullen. Really appreciate all your thoughts and insights into our case so far. So I have the patient here with me. This patient was transferred to us from an outside hospital, and we're now seeing her for the first time on her second day of her total hospitalization timeline. Her initial vital signs are significant for a heart rate of 138, a blood pressure of 114 over 89 while on 3 vasopressors. And she was also noted to be tachypneic to a rate of 34 and febrile to 104 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 degrees Celsius. On her exam, we note that she's intubated, tachypneic, and in notable distress. She's tachycardic with a regular rhythm, no murmurs, and no peripheral edema. Her extremities were cool with a delayed capillary refill of about 3 to 4 seconds, and her lung exam demonstrated bilateral rails at the bases. She has also notable submandibular lymphadenopathy. We also got labs for her during her stay. While she was admitted, we got our initial set of blood work and workup for her. The white blood cell count was initially 3.2 on arrival. However, within 1 to 2 days, shot up to 53. However, this should be of note that it was while on stress dose steroids for her shock. She also had a notable hyponatremia to 125, acute kidney injury with a creatinine of 1.5 that peaked to 2.2, severely elevated transaminitis with an initial AST of 659 that rose to a peak of 5,000, an ALT at 240 that rose to a peak of 1,500, an elevated INR to 2.5, an elevated lactate initially to 6.8, elevated LDH of 11,000, and most notably, her initial troponin was 0.03. However, within less than 24 hours, it rose to 9.8, and within 48 hours, went to a peak of 29.8. The rest of her workup included a chest x-ray that demonstrated cardiomegaly with bilateral pleural effusions and pulmonary vascular congestion. The ICU team did get a point-of-care ultrasound. If you look at the pleural effusion, that showed a moderate with right greater than left-sided pleural effusion. We did get multiple ECGs during her hospitalization while we were trending her troponins. Most notably, though, Her ECG was significant for normal sinus rhythm with diffuse ST segment elevations that were concave up in the inferior and anterior lateral leads. Specifically, we saw a spotted sign also present in lead 2 on her ECG. Spotted sign is typically noted to be a downsloping TP segment seen as an early ECG manifestation in about 30% of patients with pericarditis. It's best visualized in leads 2 and the lateral precordial leads. And during all of this, with her fever and her abnormal ECG, they did a further bacterial and viral workup. Specifically, we got a sputum-gram stain that showed moderate PMNs with light mixed oral flora and a pleural fluid gram stain that showed gram-negative rots.
So this 23-year-old female initially presented with a cardiac arrest in the setting of sore throat and snorting heroin. Now that we're seeing her deteriorate into this undifferentiated shock, we see these troponin values starting to increase markedly from almost nothing to now 29,000. But now I'm really concerned about what the state of her heart is and what that's doing, if that could be the etiology of her shock.
Yeah, Colin, I think that's a really good point. And you know, something else that we always have to think about is, especially when we see troponin and PEA arrest and shock, is the troponin primary or secondary, right? And sometimes the degree of troponin elevation can tell you about that, but honestly, anecdotally, you know, we've seen troponin elevations quite high, even in, you know, type 2 NSTEMIs, right? And demand ischemia related to something else driving the shock. But I think what stands out to me here is those pericarditis changes that we see on the ECG, right? Spotic sign, diffuse concave up ST elevation, right? So that combined with the significantly elevated troponin, the degree of shock is starting to suggest really a myopericarditis type of picture here. And then, of course, now we have to reconcile that with the fever and the sore throat and epiglottic edema, knowing that in a young, otherwise seemingly healthy person, there's usually going to be one unifying diagnosis. So it seems like there's some kind of infection, seems like there's sepsis, but we also know there's likely a myopericarditis going on right now. And you know, we have to manage her and stabilize her, but we also have to figure out how we're going to further differentiate this and actually find an etiology that we can treat.
Thank you so much, Colin and Andrew. Those are great points. So we definitely are now concerned more for a myopericarditis picture. However, there's still other things that we would eventually would like to rule out moving forward. But specifically speaking on myopericarditis, it can be caused by various different things. So we're looking at infectious and non-infectious causes. Specifically here with the fever and the ECG changes and the white count that we saw significantly rise, we're thinking more infectious. So we're thinking viruses or bacteria. More rarely, however, you can get fungal myopericarditis and parasitic involvement as well. When it comes to viruses, we're thinking Coxsackie, adenovirus, parvovirus, HIV, flu, EBV, or even CMV. Bacteria, most commonly we see Coxiella, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, etc. So with that said, you know, we want to gather more information to really assist patient and further delineate her shock. So typically for the next step in diagnosis, we would get an echocardiogram and a right heart catheterization. And treatment would continue getting her through her shock and treat whatever underlying cause this is whenever we figure this out. So Andrew, tell us more about her imaging. Take us to the echo lab.
Thanks. Yeah. So of course, you know, this is the CardioNerds. We got an echo and going to go through some of the basic images here, but essentially it showed a non-dilated LV with a globally reduced LVF estimated to be about 20%, as well as severe RV dysfunction. Now, we were also looking for issues with the pericardium, potentially tamponade, et cetera, given the changes we saw in the ECG. And really, there was a minimal, if any, pericardial effusion, actually. The other notable findings are there was actually some septal flattening in diastole, which is a typical finding in RV volume overload. So when we pair that with the findings of severe RV systolic dysfunction, we're also now worried about her shock being at least in part due to RV failure. So overall, we see evidence of severe biventricular dysfunction, no significant pericardial effusion, certainly no evidence of tamponade. So this was definitely a helpful echo, at least in trying to figure out what was happening here. Because her shock was so severe, though, and undifferentiated, remember the top two differentials here at this point were cardiogenic due to biventricular failure, plus or minus septic shock. This patient was febrile. Her pleural fluid was growing gram-negative rods. So we went for a right heart catheterization to further differentiate, which would help in the management. So I should mention that before every right heart catheterization, you know, it's standard to take note of the vitals so that you can know the systemic vascular resistance, et cetera. So with a blood pressure of 118 over 82, a MAP of 94, albeit on three different pressors, vasopressors, epinephrine, norepinephrine, and vasopressin, and on 100% FiO2 on the ventilator, our numbers were an RA of 13, PA of 21 over 13 with a mean of 16, a wedge pressure of 13, a PA SAD of 63% with an AO SAD of 96% and a hemoglobin of 10.4. So that calculated overall to a cardiac output and cardiac index of 3.1 liters per minute and 2.7 liters per minute per meter squared, respectively by FIC. Thermos were actually not done because this was done at the bedside in the ICU without the capacity to do thermodilution. With these numbers, her systemic vascular resistance was quite high, actually at 2,090 dynes centimeters to the fifth. And interestingly, her pulmonary vascular resistance was only one Wood unit, so not suggesting significantly elevated pulmonary vascular resistance. Her pulmonary artery pressure index, which can be a surrogate of RV function, is the pulmonary artery systolic minus the pulmonary diastolic divided by the RA pressure, divided by the congestion reflected back from the RV, was 0.6, indicating pretty severe RV dysfunction. And her cardiac power output was 0.44, which essentially marked to us that she had a very high risk of mortality related to her shock. So yeah, essentially with these numbers, this was indicating predominantly cardiogenic shock. We can see here that on all of the support she's on, she has an adequate cardiac index and output, at least by the SMFIC. And her filling pressures were pretty much optimized, but we can tell she's in significant biventricular failure based on all of these numbers. And she's very clamped down. Her systemic vascular resistance is super high at 2,100 dynes, albeit on some peripheral vasopressors as well. Yes, so certainly at this point, we were concerned that she was infected with the fever, the leukocytosis, gram-negative rods in the pleural fluid, but also that she's in fulminant cardiogenic shock due to a myopericarditis that is likely related to whatever's causing her underlying infectious picture. So naturally, our next step was to have a multidisciplinary discussion with cardiac surgery, with the interventional cardiology team, with the primary medical ICU team about mechanical circulatory support.
So Andrew, this right heart catheterization is of critical significance. You know, we have this patient who's now basically in fulminant cardiogenic shock on multiple vasoactive medications, like essentially rocket fuel. We're giving her almost the maximal support that we could possibly give her. Her RA is high, so she does have higher filling pressures on the right side. And you've kind of demonstrated us clearly that she's in biventricular failure. You know, both RV and LV are not doing hot. And we have an etiology, it's a myopericarditis, and we'll further get to the bottom of drill down to be what is the actual ultimate etiology of that. But, you know, when we're having somebody with lymphadenopathy and clearly infected, right, we really want to tease out, is this infection? Is this a sepsis-driven process or is it a cardiogenic process? And clearly it's a cardiogenic process and her SVR is elevated. And this really is pointing us to more of a cardiogenic etiology and source for her to develop this hemodynamic compromise. And while we have her now somewhat stabilized on multiple pressors, the question that I'd be asking myself is, okay, so the cardiac index is 2.7 liters per minute per meter squared on the current therapy, but are we doing a good job? And that will always come back to end organ perfusion. How is that lactate going? Is it trending down? Have we stabilized? What's her creatinine doing? What's her renal function doing? What's her urine output doing? And other signs of end organ perfusion to see if we're in the right direction. Now, if we're going in the wrong direction, then we would have to strongly consider mechanical circulatory support, although we know she's infected and it's literally bacteremic. So that would give us a major amount of pause before jumping into that. But those are the things that I'd be considering. If things are going in the right direction, then I think that with the medications that we're doing the right job. We're supporting her. We'll get her through this. And hopefully we'll avoid the need for mechanical circulatory support and continue to stay the course. So I'm really curious. I almost wish I was a fly on the wall during those shock team calls. Do you have any insights of what the discussion was like?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So clearly this is a not so straightforward case. And there was some mixed evidence of what you're talking about. She did essentially become anuric and needed to be started on CRRT for clearance of toxins and volume status. However, her lactate and her LFTs actually started trending in the right direction. And I should mention that her, you know, post-arrest, she was cooled by the targeted temperature management protocol and sedated. But eventually, when they were able to assess her neurologic status, she was actually intact and perfusing her brain. So by most of our measures, with just her current vasopressor support therapy, she was actually doing okay, minus the anuric renal injury for which she had to be started on CRRT. So the discussion certainly escalated to MCS because of how sick she was and the cardiogenic shock. And when we were thinking about MCS, there are several different options, right? Kind of on the low end of the spectrum is a, at least for LV support, is a balloon pump or something like an Impella. And then, of course, this goes as high as VA ECMO. And in her case, though, if we're thinking critically about her right heart cath, a balloon pump or Impella would not be enough for her. Her RA to wedge pressure was 1. Her PAPI was 0.6. So these are all indicators of severe RV failure. So if we offloaded her LV alone with a balloon pump or Impella, that actually would not have been enough support for her, and she would have had even worsening RV failure because her RV already can't support that preload that it's getting. So really the decision was VA ECMO or leave her on what she's on, which is essentially just pressures and inotropes. And because of how she was doing clinically, because of the concerns that she had some kind of disseminated bacterial infection that we didn't know, but clearly gram-negative rods and the pleural fluid and the myopericarditis, the decision was actually made to not put her on ECMO and instead just treat her supportively with antibiotics and pressors. So, Cullen, can you fill us in on the rest of her clinical course and how she did after that?
Yes, thanks, Andrew. So, excellent summary of some of the complex discussions that were going on regarding her care and the decision to not pursue MCS, which was difficult. So, as we continued to support her care, we continued antibiotics. And as we mentioned, she had blood cultures that were positive for gram-negative rods. Eventually, that speciated to Haemophilus influenzae, which is a very interesting organism for someone who's a young adult. It's not something you typically would see. The pleural fluid cultures ended up speciating as Haemophilus influenzae, which fortunately is very treatable. And being isolated from the pleural space is diagnostic for a true infection of this organism. It's very strange to see this in a young lady in her early 20s, but thankfully we had this organism that we can now treat and address, and she's already on broad spectrum antibiotics, which are addressing the problem. So Angie, I did not complete a pediatrics residency, but I wonder, is this something that you've ever encountered to this degree in a patient?
No, so long story short, so yes, there is a lot of prevention that happens throughout the early ages, from birth up to school age, you're vaccinated for Haemophilus influenzae, amongst other bacteria and viruses that have been deemed to be very dangerous for children. So we've seen the rates of Haemophilus influenzae, like severe presentations, actually go down significantly. I've never seen during my training as a med ped resident, I've never seen an infection to this degree, let alone an infection that required an ICU stay, actually. So preventable.
Yeah. And I'll just add, like, it's amazing. This patient presented with an epicleptitis, basically, right? Colin, you were kind of like reflecting on this age group is something that we're totally not expected. So like back in med school, you know, like I was primed for those USMLE. You know, if you said, oh, a young patient presented with shock and had epicleptitis, difficult to intubate, you know, like you'd be like Haemophilus influenzae, like it'd be coming right out of your mouth. Here it's like, anaphylaxis, this, that, you know what I mean? Like, it's amazing that like the clinical context and what you're used to taking care of totally will shift you away and anchor bias. I don't know if anchor bias is the correct bias, but bias you away from the board given answer that we probably could have recognized from the beginning.
And Dan, if I can add to that anchoring bias, you know, this patient was actually seen in the winter of the Delta wave surge of COVID when the entire hospital was filled with COVID. So we're seeing fever, we're seeing upper respiratory issues, we're seeing myopericarditis. She probably got 6 COVID tests, right? Because everyone was convinced she had COVID. So it's another important teaching point here. It's just reflecting that even in the area where common things are common. Always keep the differential broad because it does change your management, right? Bacterial causes of myopericarditis are rare, but treatable.
Yeah, I just did a quick Google search. In countries that include routine vaccination, the rates of severe Haemophilus influenza have decreased by more than 90%. So it's very rare to see a presentation like this in patients who are vaccinated, which this patient was.
So we'll continue the clinical course for the rest of our hospital stay. So as far as the infectious etiology, we already discussed that Haemophilus influenza helped to clinch the diagnosis for the cause of the underlying infection, but also the cause of her cardiogenic shock and myocarditis. A bronchoscopy was also done for completeness sake, and it was negative for any AFB smear organisms. Respiratory viral pathogen panel, including COVID tests, multiple were negative, including through the bronchoscopy. Blood cultures had no growths. Our infectious disease colleagues recommended a thorough immunodeficiency workup, which had normal immunoglobulin levels, negative HIV. And of note, she did have prior vaccination against Haemophilus influenza, which I believe Angie did mention previously. As she was continued on the antibiotics, her Prussia requirement gradually reduced until she was weaned off completely. We were able to narrow antibiotics to ceftriaxone, and she was able to start making urine to come off of the CRRT that had been transitioned to intermittent dialysis. And finally, most satisfying for us cardio nerds is that an echocardiogram was repeated before her discharge, and it showed her LVEF had improved to 55 to 60% with normal RV function. We can all breathe a sigh of relief.
Well, that is fantastic news. What a great outcome. And it just demonstrates that supportive care with application of the etiology of hemodynamic compromise can really be life-saving. And you just all demonstrated the absolute amazing cohesive heart team that University of Maryland proudly sports. And this patient was definitely served really well by you all.
We can list her diagnoses that we gave her. Yes, her final diagnosis or diagnoses that we managed her for: disseminated Haemophilus influenza that caused her epiglottitis, leading to a hypoxic cardiac arrest with a co-committent presumed fulminant bacterial myocarditis, since we didn't actually do a cardiac biopsy, or we were not able to do a cardiac MRI to give a complete diagnosis of the myocarditis, though the clinical evidence really pointed in that direction with her EKG and her severe shock for the cardiogenic predominance. Andrew, would you mind summarizing some of the takeaway learning points that we want our listeners to go home with after listening to this very challenging case?
Yeah, thanks. So first off, one of the main learning points is, although it's very common to see an elevated troponin biventricular dysfunction post-cardiac arrest, one of the clinching data points for us was actually the ECG, which showed those pericarditis changes and actually helped narrow down that there's a true underlying myopericarditis. And so an ECG is very, very helpful post-arrest in actually identifying the underlying etiology. Secondly, as I think we mentioned before, especially in the area of COVID and all the respiratory viruses that are by far and large the most common causes of myocarditis, it's important to always consider a broad differential diagnosis, especially in considering alternative infections such as bacterial or even more rarely fungal and parasitic that Angie mentioned, and then even non-infectious causes of myocarditis, because this will significantly change your treatment course. Third, as we saw here, the right heart cath really made a big difference. It did not actually change our management in this case, but it clearly identified biventricular failure and severe cardiogenic shock, both LV and RV. And had this case gone differently, had the lactate gone up and markers of perfusion gone the wrong way, the patient would have likely wound up on VA ECMO. And finally, an infectious myocarditis, the shock may be multifactorial. There can be vasodilatory components from sepsis. In this case, the predominant etiology was more cardiogenic.
Thank you so much for that summary, Andrew. Now, Andrew, Colin, and Angie, thank you so much for joining us today. This is a really important case, and we just learned a chock full of information, and we are glad that the patient is doing better, and we have learned a ton. So thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you all for having us.
Thank you.
Blast.
And now for the ECPR segment of our faculty director, Dr. Stan Liu. He is our associate program director for our medical consult service and the strongest advocate for medical education in our program. He's great to work with and is always super involved and willing to help us further our education and train us to be better clinician educators amongst residents and amongst ourselves and amongst faculty. We're very excited to have him today.
And as a Cardi Nerds first, I'm going to jump in there. I have to add, Dr. Stan Liu was one of the most influential people that I met right when I was, you know, at the crossroads of what should I go into, medicine or surgery. I was a third year medical student and I met him while he was a second year fellow at University of Maryland, and him and Dr. Brian Barr were both fellows together. And we were just talking about cardiology and I saw how excited they were about it. And I saw how excited they were about medical education. And I realized that like those were the passions that I was for. I was so inspired, and I definitely owe so much to Dr. Liu and Dr. Barr for everything that they did during those weeks that I spent with them in the cath lab. I'm so appreciative. So I'm super excited to hear what Dr. Stan Liu has to say.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome and the chance to be here. Andrew, Cullen, and Angie, I speak for all of us at the University of Maryland Fellowship Program when I say how proud we are of you. Dan, incredibly proud of you as one of our spectacular alums too. Let's recap this case that you also excellently presented. We heard the story of a young woman who presented with throat pain and shortness of breath, escalating to respiratory failure requiring intubation and PEA arrest. Importantly, epiglottal edema was noted during intubation. She subsequently developed multi-organ failure and shock requiring pressors with ECG evidence of pericarditis and invasive hemodynamic data suggestive of biventricular cardiogenic shock. She was found to have Haemophilus influenza bacteremia that was thought to be a unifying diagnosis of her initial presentation and the cause of mild pericarditis that thankfully resolved with antibiotics. There are three learning points I'd like to highlight in this case. First, bacteremia from any source has the potential to lead to myocarditis. Second, the management of cardiogenic shock is a team sport best guided by invasive hemodynamic data. And third, a multi-specialty based approach can help prevent cognitive biases from limiting your ability to correctly diagnose a patient. Let's start with take-home point number one. Bacteremia from any source can potentially lead to myocarditis. Recall that myocarditis is an inflammatory process and can therefore be caused by any process that leads to whole body inflammation. And we frequently think of causes such as giant cell, viral myocarditis, and autoimmune disorders. But remember that infection by other pathogens can also cause whole body inflammation. Bacterial-induced myocarditis, while far less common than viral myocarditis, is still very well documented. The most common bacterial infections associated with myocarditis include Corynebacter diphtheria, Lyme disease, tuberculosis, especially in developing countries, group A streptococcal, and strep pneumonia infections. But as this case demonstrates, even less common causes of bacteremia can cause myocarditis. Keep myocarditis in the differential whenever you have a bacteremic patient with newly decreased myocardial function. Take-home point number two. The management of cardiogenic shock is a team sport best guided by invasive hemodynamic data. In this case, multiple in-depth discussions between intensivists, cardiologists, mechanical circulatory support experts, and infectious disease were all vitally important to making the correct diagnosis, providing the right treatment, and perhaps most importantly, avoiding the wrong interventions. Many of you may be training in hospitals which have developed a multidisciplinary shock team to achieve that same goal by consistently involving a heart failure cardiologist, interventionalist, intensivist, and cardiothoracic surgeons in every cardiogenic shock patient who presents to the hospital. And if you are, I highly encourage you to study the algorithm your team uses. And if you're not, I suggest you do an image search for shock team protocol so that you can see the algorithm and flowchart cards used at other hospitals. The first step a shock team takes in assessing a suspected cardiogenic shock patient is to obtain a right heart catheterization. In addition to deriving the cardiac index and pulmonary capillary wedge pressure,
two additional indices that were mentioned during this case presentation are important to guide therapy. One is the cardiac power output, a strong correlate of in-hospital mortality and cardiogenic shock. And this is defined as the cardiac output times the mean arterial pressure divided by 451, and a CPO of less than 0.6 is suggestive of severe left ventricular dysfunction. The second is the pulmonary artery pulsatility index, defined as the PA systolic pressure minus the PA diastolic pressure divided by the mean RA pressure. A PAPI less than 1 is suggestive of severe RV dysfunction. Together, these measures help differentiate the patients who have LV dominant, RV dominant, or biventricular cardiogenic shock to guide choice in mechanical circulatory support or lend evidence that it is safe to wean inotropes and vasopressors. So in a patient with concern for cardiogenic shock, get that right heart cath quickly and assemble the whole team to make the best treatment choice based on the hemodynamic data obtained. Take home point number 3. A multi-specialty based approach can help prevent cognitive biases from limiting your ability to correctly diagnose a patient. During this case presentation, Dan made an insightful observation that had this been a board exam question, child presents with acute shortness of breath, fever, epiglottitis, the classic board answer is Haemophilus influenza. But that's not how this case was presented in reality to the cardiology team. The patient still had acute shortness of breath, fever, and epiglottitis. But this is an adult. And by the way, cardiology, we need your help because she's now in shock and has severe biventricular failure. That simple change in presentation guaranteed that nobody, myself included, was thinking about Haemophilus influenza during the early days of her hospitalization. This bias is known as the framing effect, which is the tendency to draw different conclusions on the same data based on how the information is presented, and it can drastically impact patient care. One of my favorite ways to teach the power of the framing effect to students and trainees on the cardiology consult service at the University of Maryland is to present to them the true case of an elderly patient with atrial fibrillation on therapeutic warfarin who presented with deteriorating mental status requiring intubation for airway protection. A head CT is negative, but cardiology is consulted because her ECGs are now showing newly developing deep symmetric T-wave inversions in her precordial leads, and she now has an elevated troponin. I will ask you what I usually ask my trainees at this point. What is going on and what would you recommend at this point? I encourage you to pause this podcast for a second and take a few seconds to make your own consult recommendations. Almost all of them will recommend that we start a heparin drip to treat acute coronary syndrome, obtain a stat echocardiogram to rule out wall motion abnormalities, and get ready to activate the catheterization lab. Then I asked the students and trainees what they would recommend if they were instead on a neurology rotation and they were being consulted for neurology recommendations. What usually happens is the eyes of the most senior person on the team will get wide open and they will say, get a brain MRI / MRA to rule out an acute head bleed. These are neurogenic T waves. And oh no, please immediately discontinue the heparin that the cardiologist ordered. The simple fact that they are on a cardiology rotation being quizzed by me affects how they interpret the data. Almost everyone initially misses that this is actually a neurology case of an intracranial hemorrhage, not a cardiology one. I've asked the cardio nurse team to provide a link to this published case on their show notes in case you would like to use it as a teaching tool for your own trainees and students to highlight the power of the framing effect. How do you keep this cognitive bias from affecting your ability to correctly diagnose a patient? First, be conscious of the fact that by definition, every cardiology consultation you will ever receive will be framed in a cardiovascular lens. I know all of you can think of cases in which that lens was clearly not appropriate in hindsight. Engaging consultants from other specialties involved in your patient's care is one of the best ways to resist the framing effect because it will force you to view the same data from multiple frames and in doing so increase your chances of determining the best path forward for your patients. In any case where there is disagreement on how best to proceed clinically, I strongly encourage you to take the time to have a respectful discussion with other teams with the goal of not pushing your frame onto others, but understanding the frame others are viewing the same data so you can better evaluate your own. Let's recap our take-homes. Number one, bacteremia from any source has the potential to lead to myocarditis. Number two, the management of cardiogenic shock is a team sport best guided by invasive hemodynamic data. And number three, a multi-specialty based approach can help prevent cognitive biases such as the framing effect from limiting your ability to correctly diagnose a patient. Thank you so much to the Cardio Nerds for the outstanding work you do to democratize cardiovascular education. I wish all of you and all the listeners out there success and fulfillment in your training and your careers.
Thanks for tuning in to another Cardio Nerds episode. The audio editing for this episode was performed by me, Chelsea Amo-Tunaboa. I'm an intern in the Cardio Nerds Academy, House of Tossing, and a resident at the Stony Brook University Hospital in Stony Brook, New York. Check out the episode page for show notes and references. If you found this episode or show informative, please consider subscribing to Cardio Nerds on your favorite podcast platform and leaving us a review. It really helps us spread the word and further our goal to democratize cardiovascular education. Finally, this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice. The views expressed on our show and site do not reflect the opinions or policies of our employers. All Cardio Nerds content is planned, produced, and reviewed solely by the Cardio Nerds. Stay tuned for more engaging conversations and explorations in our upcoming episodes. And now, it's time to make like an S2 and split.